Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's Talky Bit. It's good to be with you all. We gather in this part of the world on Treaty 1 territory. I heard an Indigenous journalist speaking about some other issues in in this land earlier this week, and using the terms Canada and Turtle Island interchangeably, and I thought back on it later, and I was grateful that they did that, the reminder of these realities here in this part of the world. And I also sort of felt a little bit like I sometimes feel around gendered language and its evolution, like we're not there yet. We don't have good new language that holds together things that contain more possibilities than we had in mind, we being humans, had in mind when we evolved the language to its previous point, that we need new words for these new realities, new language for these new constructs that we're trying so hard to get to work for everybody. That's maybe one of those circumstances where the possibilities have become so expansive that it almost, it's like if you're a writer, remember when teachers used to sometimes in school give you those horrid assignments where they just said, here's a blank sheet of, in my early school years, it would have been foolscap. Anyway, you know, those long, narrow sheets of paper, and they give you one of those and it's empty. And they're like, fill this up. You can write about whatever you want. And I was like, God, no, not whatever I want. Somebody give me some parameters here. That's too expansive. It's overwhelming. Sometimes I think that's what this space can feel like. But it's in spaces like that, if we are bold and we do not give up, that something new can come to be. And the hopeful part of me says something better can come to be, something that continues to expand in beautiful and good and loving ways. Let's breathe together this morning. I want to do something a little bit different in the sense that we're going to just be still for a few moments. And again, the acknowledgement that this does not work for everybody. This is not a given. It's an opportunity. If it works for you, I'm delighted. Engage away. If it doesn't, don't engage. Don't do it out of obligation. This is not about that. But for those that are participating, we're just going to be still for a little bit and let our breathing slow down. So kind of consciously just bring it down a little bit, and then I'll give us a little something to go with that after a few moments, where we'll count our breaths and really, really be mindful of our breath being peaceful and us being peaceful. All right. So just take a few moments, first of all, and just slow down if you're in a situation where you can do that, and let your breathing be sort of the signal that you're slowing down for a few moments. All right. Here we go. All right, so now we'll count our breaths, something we're familiar with. So in through our nose for a count of four, fill yourself right up. Cradle our breath for a count of six, and then we'll exhale for a count of eight. On the exhale, this is a little different part. On the exhale, initially on the first one, just think as you're exhaling the phrase, my breath is peaceful and calm. And then we'll do another round. And on that exhale, I am peaceful and calm. We'll do a pair of those, all right? And I'll remind us of what we're doing. Okay, here we go. Big breath in all the way. Cradle your breath. Count of six. And exhale, and while exhaling, be mindful of my breath is peaceful and calm. Breath in. Cradle your breath. And on the exhale, I am peaceful and calm. without the directions. Peace, everybody. Bit of a circuit breaker, among other things. My goodness, speaking of language, here's the thing. As the phrase circuit breaker came out of my mouth, I was like, oh, you know, Tim, choose a different metaphor, because that one's been affiliated with, pandemic restrictions far too much in the last 2 years. A positive interruption in the patterns that make us wound up, tight, and stressed. That's what breathing like that can be, a chance to sort of slow down our racing thoughts, get us out of the swirl of endless news feeds and conflicting, polarized points of view on everything under the sun, and just breathe, be aware of our bodies, our minds, our spirits, and their integration, and remind ourselves that we can choose moments, even in the midst of that swirl. We can choose moments where our breath is peaceful and calm, and we are peaceful and calm, or at least more peaceful and calmer. Hey, that works too. When it comes to what I usually call folk sayings in my life, my kind of frame of reference, my go-to is my late maternal grandfather. I've talked about him in this space before. He was a sort of a salt of the earth kind of person. He was someone who made his way in the world primarily by the strength of his body as a young man. He was a logger. He was a farmer. And then he was crippled by MS, like in his 20s, as quite a young guy. Also had to recover later in his life from a bout with tuberculosis. Had a hard life in ways that I'm utterly unfamiliar with. And yet, this was a person who never seemed to lose interest in the world around him, and especially in the collecting of these short, pithy sayings that summed up big, complex issues or behaviors or offered some insight about the nature of the world. I suppose it'd be fair to call them, I call them folk sayings usually, but some of them actually had more time and distance to them, which is when sort of a folk saying becomes a proverb and over time can become an adage. So he had some of those. And my mom, while not as prone to sort of tossing those into conversation as her dad, my mom definitely carries within her an inherited collection of these sayings. And it's her voice that I hear in my head when I find myself wishing for something to be different, but not necessarily being willing to do the work of changing what I have agency to change. And what I hear my mom's voice saying in those moments is, if wishes were horses, beggars would ride. In other words, the thing you think you need isn't going to just happen because you wish it would. You got to work for it. Now, as with any proverb, there can readily be a correlating piece of wisdom that addresses another, and many times often an apparently opposite or contrary perspective, which I think is part of the nature of wisdom. It reminds us that life is not as simple as an adage. I was reflecting on this particular proverb in light of that, and it occurred to me that, although I've never heard this saying, probably because the poetics aren't as good, among other things, but you could say, if you were born rich, wishes were horses. You could wish for a horse and there would be a horse, pretty much, right? Something along those lines, something that reflects the fact that those with greater agency and those with less agency can have very different experiences of the same world. For my part, if I was going to be a wishful thinking beggar on something, I wish I had more time to read. I try to read quite widely in terms of areas of interest or disciplines, and then try to have at least a dash of fiction and poetry in the mix, for which I'm grateful, among other things, to this community for continuing to feed me interesting ideas, especially as regards fiction lately. I am not complaining about the state of my life when I talk about this. That would just be ridiculous in any wider context. That said, if I had the agency to simply wish for something to come true, zappo presto, it would be to somehow have more time to read, but without there being any less time for everything else, because the everything else is more than not, it's good. I don't want to do away with it to make time to read. I want to, another adage, I want to have my cake and eat it too. Well, in lieu of that being the case, because it isn't the case, one of the things that I've been learning is that, as we considered last week, if I think about myself as part of a larger whole and I ask more questions of others, I can learn a lot from the humans that I share the world with. It's incredible how much information and wisdom is just one question, just one conversation away. You think about it this way. If 20 people all read a bit and then we talk with one another, it's sort of like we all read a lot. And of course, that doesn't just apply to reading, it applies to all of life. Our collective knowledge, our collective wisdom, our collective skill for living far outstrips anything we could acquire on our own. And the more I apply this kind of thinking to my own life, the more I start to see patterns of what I would call collective change, things that it seems like when I start asking questions of people, I start exercising my curiosity and my intrigue, it seems like I start bumping into things that many of us are thinking about, that many of us are working through, that many of us are seeking to know more about and to change in our lives and in the wider world around us. Not always from the, in fact, often not from the same perspective, often provoked by different particular circumstances. But when we actually start to have these conversations, this realization that, oh, there are coalescing themes here. That's an intriguing thing to me. One of those conversations this past week was with a friend who is involved in leading an organization that provides resources and training for leaders in the workplace, in particular, workplace culture training. And this person, in the course of our conversation, asked me if I had read a particular author, because some of the ideas we were discussing, things that we both had an interest in and some passion about and some thoughts about, suggested to her that maybe I had read this particular author. I'd never heard of this person or their work, but I was thinking about similar things, apparently, to what they'd been writing about, so my interest was piqued. Now, this author's name that my friend was referring to is Frederick Laloux, because I know right now some of you have your thumbs on your phone. Laloux is L-A-L-O-U-X. The book is called Reinventing Organizations. Now, as the angels were fond of saying, do not be afraid. I'm not going to launch off into a talky bit on organizational structure. But since we gather in this community to explore what we believe, what I am going to do is draw on an idea of Laloux's that I believe applies to us as a community, and to set that up by telling you one of his stories. So this is, if you will, a way of drawing on collective wisdom, of drawing on ideas that are swirling around us. When Laloux wrote this book and self-published it, he had no idea what kind of nerve he was touching. Anyway, you can, if you follow this up and you end up on his website, you'll see that story there. I won't tell it now. In 2016, Laloux was part of a conference called Power and Care, which was organized by a group in Europe called Mind and Life Europe. And he was there on the invitation of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who's involved with Mind and Life Europe. And in his presentation at that conference, he summed up his ideas about reinventing organizations. And I know I won't do justice to the, you know, almost 400 pages that is the book, but the very simplest version of his thinking about that is ditch the pyramid, ditch the top-down structure, and make organizations that work like the rest of the living world. In other words, make organizations that are like organisms, that have self-organizing structures. Make organizations that are places where we can live into wholeness and we can sense into purpose, as opposed to organizations that are home for power hierarchies, places where we seek safety through separation, and where we try to predict and control the future. I listened to him sum that up, and I just thought, oh my goodness. Like all the years that I can remember being involved in religious organizations where the mantra was, let's take best business practice and apply it to the business of religion. That was almost entirely pyramidic and always bugged me that it was vertical. And then I found out that, you know, the tradition I was standing in, the Judeo-Christian tradition, borrowed heavily in those structures, not just from Best Business, but before that from Hebrew religious structures, Jewish religious structures, you know, around the time of Christ, and before that from the Hebrew structures. And the Hebrew structures were borrowed from the Egyptian structures, which were, surprise, pyramidic. So anyway, I was just fascinated by that intersection, among other things. Anyways, here we go. At the end of his presentation, which was very warmly received, one of the moderators asked him to provide a practical example, which sort of cracked the whole room up. I think everybody in the room was kind of like, yeah, nice theory there, Mr. Lolo. Let's, you know, time for some real world stuff, which he rose to. And the conference was situated in Belgium, so Lolo chose an organization from the neighboring country of the Netherlands. And here's sort of the short version of the story that he told. He does a fair bit of work with the healthcare industry, and this story comes from that part of business and economy. The story that he told was about how in the Netherlands, in their health care for seniors, so nurses working outside of the hospital in particular, their model was based on the idea of increased efficiency. And the fundamental metaphor for the organization was that it was a complex machine. Again, most of us would be very familiar with this idea, right? Because it's the dominant idea. We think of ourselves, we have thought of ourselves for hundreds of years in Western thought, European influence thought about ourselves as complex machines, our brains as complex machines. It's remarkable when you start watching for it how much this has been applied to spirituality as well, and the language keeps creeping in. I keep finding it in my own language. We're wired for this, we're built for that, and so on and so forth. Anyway, so that's sort of how they were thinking about it. This business of caring, providing healthcare for seniors is a complex machine, and in order to have it run as well as possible, our goal is to have it be as efficient as possible. And so they were using sort of the traditional approach to honing those efficiencies. They were quantifying tasks. They were measuring how long things take. They were recording that. They were assigning higher-end nurses to higher-end tasks because that's sort of the financial equation. You want to pay your more paid people to be doing, quote, higher-value things. They were making sure no time was wasted. They were saying every task that you're doing with a senior person in senior care takes about this long, so an injection takes 2 minutes. Putting on compression stockings takes 5 minutes. Changing a bandage takes 6 minutes. And then to get this really honed, they were like, we're going to put barcode stickers outside the seniors' doors. So when you're there, you just scan in, and when you're done, you just scan out and you log what the task was, and we'll know exactly how long the task took. And that way we can find out, oh, you know what, a shower, helping someone with a shower should take 15 minutes. You usually take 17. So we're going to provide you with some more training so you can be more efficient about helping people shower, and then you can be on to the next task more efficiently. And that's how we're going to hone this thing and get the most from it. Among other things, of course, that meant that they started watching for gaps in care provider schedules and assigning them based on their use of time. And so that one of the things that meant is that seniors were always seeing different nurses because they were seeing whoever was available with the shortest drive and so on and so forth, all these efficiencies. So it appeared to be a model of increasing efficiency and productivity in which humans involved could complete more and more tasks in the same amount of available time. But there was a fundamental problem. The nurses and the clients both hated it. And eventually, someone inside of that system grew weary of the ways that it violated their integrity as a nurse because they knew that they were doing bad work with people, but they were not being given the time to do it differently. And because they could see that this approach robbed those being cared for of deep human connection and of their own sense of agency. And so this person just started their own company. Jos Dubloc was the name of the nurse. So same industry, different kind of company. Starts out with just four people working with him. And Dubloc said from the outset that his purpose was not for the nurses in his organization to deliver more efficient services, but for the patients that they cared for to lead as rich and autonomous a life as they could. So the nurses in Dubloc's organization take the time to sit and have coffee with the clients, to learn what those clients can still do, what they can no longer do, to learn who they know or are already connected to that might be part of their care and of their lives and so on. If they're like, oh, you have adult kids, but they're not involved in your care because the relationship's broken down, maybe we can facilitate an improvement in that relationship. We can help, we can work there with this problem. And so each patient, another commitment from the team, each patient only sees one or at the most two different nurses, and deep caring relationships develop as a result. In 10 years, that organization went from having 4 people on its team to having 14,000 people. When they have an employment opening, they get hundreds of applicants because people want to work for them. They went, in business terms, from a 0% market share over that same period of 10 years to about 75% of the market share. So outside observers, I mean, you kind of, if you're watching that industry, it's a little hard not to notice a story like that. And outside observers, committed as they were to this previous paradigm of measure it and manage it, suspected that this was all very groovy and all very feel good, but it was no way to run a financially efficient business. And so they started to do financial studies of this company. And what they discovered was that the caregivers in this organization only use about 40% of the hours that are prescribed by doctors to provide the necessary care to their clients, because their clients become autonomous so much faster. As Lalo puts it, by drinking coffee instead of trying to squeeze out every minute of productivity, these folks in this company were saving the Dutch economy hundreds of millions of euros every year. That's an interesting story, I would say, on its own. But in our context, here's the kicker. The fascinating thing, Lalo reminds us in telling the story, is that the nurses are the same, the syringes and bandages are the same. In other words, the tasks and resources are the same. The only thing that changes is how we view the world. The only thing that changes is how we view the world. And from that sort of change in view, other changes can follow. All right. Trigger warning. I'm going to come at this from a very different angle for a few moments, and I'm going to draw on the Christian tradition for a bit and some texts from that tradition. And I just wanted, the trigger warning is just that some of these texts will be familiar if you grew up in and around certain branches of Christianity for sure. You will have heard them talked about in ways that may or may not still be resonant for you. They may, in fact, just make you want to run and scream. I'm going to come at those from a very different angle as well. So stay with me or don't, as always, but I want you to know that's part of where I'm going to be coming from for the next few minutes. So one of my kids and I were talking this past week about why the teachings of someone like Jesus might be worth examining, even if a person has absolutely no interest in or may even be antagonistic toward religion in general and perhaps Christianity in particular. And whatever we might think about this particular person, about this historic figure of Jesus, and the range of perspectives would be considerable, I would say, even within a small group like this community, whatever we might think about that person, it's pretty easy to see that over time, this is a spiritual teacher whose ideas have had an enormous impact on the world. And in my conversation with one of our kids, we talked about, for example, how most of the structures that underpin the morals and ethics of the Western world are predicated on values that Jesus launched into the culture of their time, and then which got picked up by people that turned those teachings into a religion. That religion ended up in the Middle Ages in Europe in particular, interlocked with the state, which amplified the cultural emphasis of those constructs. I would say warped them badly, but also amplified them, and hence a lot of that impact from those ideas. Now, we could, of course, say the same thing of other spiritual teachers, and certainly if we looked at this idea in other cultures, we would be talking about other spiritual teachers, of course, and it's a fascinating and worthwhile endeavor to note how much overlap there is between different systems of thought and belief. One of the lenses through which we might consider this is the lens of something that we would use words like evolving consciousness for, or human development, human evolution for. Here's a question. Why is it that some ideas seem to find traction when other, perhaps even similar ideas offered by someone else at another time, don't? One of the things that fascinates me, we're not going to go into it this morning, but just as a, you know, an adjacent idea, is how if we study history and we're not afraid to read outside of the canon a little bit, perhaps, one of the things we often find is that ideas that are now starting to challenge prevailing norms often existed right from the beginning of whatever stream of history or thought we're examining. That there have been people who were going, hey, yeah, but what about this perspective from way back in the story? Certainly true in Christianity as an historic story, the one that I would know the best in terms of studying a religion. It's pretty hard to encounter an idea in contemporary thought about Christian ideas that you can't actually find someone thinking some version of pretty much right from go. A lot of those voices got silenced, and they didn't win the which voice gets traction contest. Sometimes they got silenced in pretty brutal ways, where the writings were destroyed or buried. And when they show up in the contemporary world, like the Gnostic Gospels have done, for example, within the last 70 years or so, and we can read what other writers were writing about the same events that made it into the collection we call the Bible, and go, wait a minute, that's a really different story about the same events. That's a really different lens. The point in this context being that sometimes some ideas get traction at a certain time and others don't. And why that happens can be really complicated, but it's also very interesting. One of the reasons why it happens, we could say, is because the time is right. That there's some kind of a coalescence of influences and opportunities and power and occasion, other historic events, things that get invented. So technology, so for example, in terms of the impact of certain kinds of branches of Christian thought on wider thought, a lot of those ideas coincided with the invention of the printing press, for example. Huge amplifier for ideas, right? Anyway, sometimes the time is right, and an idea takes hold in a small group at a point in history where the conditions, whatever they might be, are right for it to thrive, and then it expands from there. So Jesus, for example, comes along teaching that when it comes to making the world a better place for everyone, including the oppressed and the marginalized, because from an historic point of view, those are his people. That's who he's talking to. When it comes to making the world a better place for everyone, including people having those experiences, it works better to love one another than it does to have a religious elite that tell us what to believe and how we can keep score to know if we're going to make it into the happy place or not. That love is actually more powerful than right belief in that regard. He comes along and he teaches that forgiveness is the key that unlocks our ability to care for one another. I love the way the Zen Buddhist monk and teacher Thich Nhat Hanh puts it. He likes to point out that and who is a big fan of Jesus' teaching, by the way, Nhat Hanh likes to point out that if we're committed to loving our enemies, by the time we know them well enough, you can't love someone you don't know, so you have to get to know them. And by the time we know them well enough to love them, they're no longer going to be our enemies. Yep. Brilliant. Not easy or simple, but genius. But to engage with ideas like that, whether we do them because we claim to follow some particular spiritual teacher or not, requires that we are willing to view the world differently. Differently than what? Differently than who? Who or whom? Don't answer that, but someone tell me later. Often as not, the answer to questions like differently than what or differently than who is differently from the dominant systems and the power holders for whom those systems are working well. Listen, it's hard. It's really, really hard for us as a species to consider changing something that is serving us well. Refined systems that are themselves the products of lots of hard work, lots of deep thought, lots of wrestling for change, lots of honing the edges, those are not the systems that necessarily strike us as calling out for change. They also have a lot of energy behind them, a lot of momentum, a lot of resources. And often, what is coming up next is pretty rough around the edges. There are fewer examples, there are fewer iterations, there are fewer reference points for whatever that emerging idea might be. That's one of the reasons why when we encounter a new idea or a different viewpoint, it can kind of make us feel like, really? I could shoot holes through that without any difficulty. I once heard someone point out that the first automobiles came along at the zenith of the horse and buggy. And this is not unusual in change models, right? Like the new idea emerges from back here and it crosses over close to the high point of some previous other ideas evolution before the previous idea starts to disintegrate or lose steam. So with the automobile and the horse and buggy, first cars were noisy, they were unreliable, there were these exhaust-spewing, ugly things. They were everything that a refined buggy and a well-trained team of horses was not. I wrote that illustration down and I thought, this is not necessarily a stellar example of change for the better, as we've seen over time, in hindsight. But I felt like it was still a pretty valid example of the change process and how what is next often appears to make less sense than what is already in place and what has been getting refined and refined and refined and refined for sometimes a long time. Now, we could use a similar argument for the teachings of Jesus. Examined from the perspective of how did they go over at the time, it's pretty hard to say that Jesus made much progress on culture change while they were alive. In fact, as we have the story, Jesus is someone that died in obscurity and relative ignominy, largely abandoned by the handful of followers that they'd managed to accumulate while alive. As we have the stories, the men were more inclined to run for cover than the women, which is an interesting lens on those stories as well. But anyway, you look at it from a contemporary vantage point, it's not what most of us would call a success story. But some of those ideas, some of those different views of the world turned out to be and continue to be, if we plug them in deeply, utter game changers. And again, I'm using this example because it's the one that I know best, not because it's the only one we could apply. There will always be a next. And we continue to evolve as a species. We learn, we change, the world around us changes, and we can resist that, of course. We can push back. We can insist that the refined present is always preferable to the rougher, less in-focus future possibilities. But change, including change for the better, grows out of a sort of fundamental willingness to be open to considering a different view of the world. I find it fascinating that one of the most influential figures in the formation of the Christian religion seemed to understand this to be the case. Some would say that the ideas of the writer that Christianity typically refers to as the Apostle Paul form much more of the actual foundation of the Christian religion than the teachings of Jesus do. I think one of the people I was reading on this at one point said we should call it Pollyannity, but having become used to calling the religion Christianity, Pollyannity just sounds so clunky. Anyway, It was a way of saying the ideas of this writer are woven everywhere through the thing we call Christianity. Anyway, I think that perspective has a lot of merit. But whatever sort of valuation we might have on that point, I think it's worth noting that Paul shares his ideas about being a Christian primarily with people that have been forced to conform by those in power, both their military oppressors who don't share their tribal religion or the religion of origin, and they're often oppressive religious leaders who historically do. It's kind of like no matter where the people Paul is writing to look, they are surrounded by systems that are not working except for those holding the power. And to those people, writing to this nascent religious group in Rome, so in the book of Romans, Paul writes this. He says, "Do not conform," so brace yourself. This is where the trigger warning part made me twitch anyway. "Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." In other words, take a different view of the world. Be willing to look at the world differently then the prevailing norms say you must. It's worth noting, I think, that the context in which Paul says that is to a group of people that he is saying, look at the religious beliefs you hold with a different view of the world. He's saying, you know, that long trajectory in the religion that you're from that is breaking down because it's been codified into right belief and managed by elite power holders who tell you what to believe and how to express that belief, and that's the mark that you have to measure to make God happy. Look at that from a different point of view. Be willing to look at the world differently than the prevailing norms, including the prevailing religious norms, say that you must. And in the case of this particular text, which you can look up for yourself, it's in Romans chapter 12. Some of you already had the reference in your head. Couldn't help yourself as soon as I read it. If you do look it up, you'll find that there's an if-then component that's offered as well. People who treat these texts as though they were dictated by God might talk about an if-then like this as though it were prescriptive and immutable. It's not where I'm coming from, as you'll be able to tell in a moment. But here's the if-then that's in the text. If you do this, so if you do not conform to the pattern of this world, but you are transformed as people by the renewing of your mind, if you do this, then, quote, you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. Oh, man. Okay, so if you grew up around modern Christianity, and perhaps especially the very young, short-lived branch of it, usually labeled evangelicalism, then this whole thing about knowing the will of God might still haunt you. In fact, way back when I said the first trigger warning, you might have already bailed, or you might just be kind of hanging onto the edge of your seat just to see if you can do this. But if you didn't bail, then let me just say that text bundles up a bunch of things that can make, if we're people who are looking for a widening space in which to examine and explore what we believe rather than a narrowing one, there's a stack of descriptors in that text that are really problematic. And we might want to start with the fact that it's so adamantly gendered. So the personification of reality is male, and that's not questioned or expanded, not in Paul's work. And then beyond that, the will of this personification of reality is something that can be known. Interesting. And furthermore, it is good, pleasing, and perfect. So if you know it, guess what you are? Right. Good, pleasing, and perfect. And if you don't, guess what you are? Bad, displeasing, and imperfect. As though good were an absolute category, or pleasing were an absolute category. Perfect is a difficult word to work with because it does generate a binary, right? That's quite the stack. Anyhow, let me suggest this. If you haven't bailed, here's where the ideas intersect. Looking at the world differently can, if that's the path we choose, make possible things like taking a view of ancient texts, among other things, that is different than the ones we were told we had to have. It makes possible things like taking a different view of a text like this without being concerned that to do so disqualifies us from things like goodness or being a pleasing person or knowing how reality works. If you've been tracking along the last few weeks, you might recall that we've considered how the word God in ancient texts was an ancient way of naming reality. So, thus saith the Lord, for the ancients equals what a 21st century person aware of what we are aware of now might use a phrase like thus saith reality for. It was a way of personifying mystery. So, let's plug that into this text for just a moment. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, the dominant systems, the ones that are working great for the power holders who've refined them over time. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. by taking a different view of the world than that one. Here's the if then. If you do this, you will be able to test and accept as satisfactory, which is the definition of the word approve. If you do this, you will be able to test and accept as satisfactory what conforms with reality, what aligns with what will be there, whether we believe it or not, in ways that work better because they more nearly approach the truth of how things are. Don't conform to the dominant systems just because they're honed and refined, but be transformed by taking a different view of the world. And if we do this, it better equips us to be able to test and accept as satisfactory what conforms with reality. It equips us to better be able to test and accept as satisfactory what aligns with what will be there, whether we believe it or not, in ways that work better because they more nearly approach the truth of how things are. I'm not sure how I felt about that last bit, more nearly approach. I liked the word approach was very important in there for me because it felt like the dynamic word. It felt like an approach is not something you do and then you're done. You can always be approaching, especially when the thing you're approaching is mystery, which is expanding as far as we can tell. The more we learn, the more we know, we only know a fragment of what might be known. So that feels like it keeps the dynamic in there that I want to keep in there. Or to put all of that language into a more condensed form, to use the ancient language for the personification of reality, willingness to look at the world differently can help us to know the will of God, know the will of reality. I'm going to leave that right there. And I'm going to leave it there with this question. Is that worth exploring? I can tell you how I answer that question in community. I answer that question in community by saying, you decide. And when enough of us decide that an idea like that is worth exploring, then there's some coalescence, there's some collective wisdom and energy and curiosity and ideas that start to gather around that exploration. And when that starts to happen in more and more groups of people, you get a conversation that intersects with more and more parts of reality. And you get something that starts to have some traction and change starts to happen. Anyway, back to you decide. I'll do the same. Some of us will end up having a conversation. It's been good to be with you all. I hope you have a fantastic week. And I look forward to continuing together with the people in this community and in the wider world, continuing to explore what we believe. Peace, everybody. Bye for now.